Hi, it's Elise Lunan, host of Pulling the Thread. Today's guest is the wonderful Rabbi Steve Leader, author of five incredible and soulful books, including For You When I Am Gone, which is about the legacy of an ethical will, which is more about words than things.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi, it's Elise Lunan, host of Pulling the Thread. I'm an author, podcast host, and parent who built a long career in media. I grew up in a state of perpetual curiosity, investigating the world and asking a lot of questions. In this show, I chat with culture-defining leaders, thinkers, and experts about this rare moment that we find ourselves in and how to think about our own lives and experiences within a larger social and spiritual construct.
There are 12 questions that enable every person who's willing to answer them to reevaluate their life and their legacy. Because what I have found with my father's death is I miss not a single material thing about my father. I mean, I have his hat on the shelf behind me, and I have a couple of his old tools, but that's it. What I really cherish, the inheritance I really cherish, are the values, the laughter, the music, the food, my love of nature. That's his legacy. His powerful bullshit meter, his powerful moral compass, his love of peoplehood. That's what we want to be sure we bequeath to our loved ones when we're gone. But it's more than just a bequest, because when you ask yourself questions like, what is love? What makes me happy? What has been my greatest failure? What do I regret? What do I want my epitaph to be? What would I say at my own funeral as a final blessing to my loved ones? These are the kinds of questions that enable us to ask whether or not we are living the life we say we believe in and the life we say matters.
So says Steve Leader, senior rabbi of Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles and the best-selling author of five books. In our conversation today, we talk about death and the creation of ethical wills, the subject of Rabbi Leader's most recent book, For You When I Am Gone, 12 Essential Questions That Tell a Life Story. The book, born of his experience helping thousands of people navigate loss, is a guide to writing a meaningful letter about your life, a so-called ethical will, which you can do at any point and any time. Things are not our legacy, the rabbi tells us, and our estate plan will not nourish our loved ones, but our words and our stories have the power to provide something lasting and meaningful for generations to come. Rabbi Leader pushes us to examine our lives, our joys, our regrets, our successes, and our failures, and to present those stories, brokenness and all, to those we love. Doing so, he says, will not only hold our loved ones when we are gone, but it can serve to redirect us now, as it forces us to examine the alignment between our professed values and the way in which we are actually living. His major takeaway? Don't wait. Our bodies may disintegrate, but our lives are defined by our stories, and we have the ability to create and leave behind worlds of meaning with our words. Okay, let's get to our conversation. I am writing about religion, actually. I'm writing a book about the patriarchy and women and the seven deadly sins and how they've culturally informed or circumscribed the lives of women and sort of where they came from and how patriarchy, like just, yeah, it's fun. It's interesting.
Oh, boy.
But it's this idea of sinning and what is it, what was the actual intention? I mean, they're fascinating cultural concepts that were never in the Bible. And so it's
Yes and no, right? I mean,
well, where do you think they're in the Old Testament?
I think they're
stated in that way.
Not in that way, no.
Yeah.
But the foundational values they articulate, definitely.
Right.
Definitely.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting the way that then they were codified and then assigned to Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
In 600.
Well, everyone rips off the Jews. I mean, that's just how it works.
Evagrius Ponticus.
Everybody rips off our style. That's just the way it is. It's true.
Oh my God.
It is. Every noble idea in Western culture comes from the Torah. People just don't know it. They just don't know it.
People don't. Yeah.
Well, it's a tribe. It's a tribe. And the tribe has its own religion.
Yeah.
But it's not the sum total of the tribe or the tribal experience.
Right.
And the other tricky part of this, like, I'm happy to talk with you about this anytime you want to talk about it, because it really is, for me, something I've dedicated my life to it. There has never been a Judaism. There have always been Judaisms.
Mm.
And that is part of the beauty of it, but also part of the challenge, because it's the answer to Jewish questions are always, it depends.
Right.
And I love that about Judaism, but it's not for everyone.
Isn't that what also, though, makes it a living faith in the
yes.
context of,
of course.
Yeah, and the fact that it's continually
even like the Hebrew word, like the psycholinguistics of it. The Hebrew word for law, for Jewish law, religious law, doctrine, commandments, is halacha, and it comes from the verb to walk or to move or to be going.
Mm.
So the view of the law is evolutionary. The very word used for it is evolutionary.
Interesting. That's beautiful. I always thought it was just mitzvah.
Well, no. Mitzvah means commandment.
Okay.
So, which has its own very interesting, because people think mitzvah means good deed, and it doesn't. It means commandment. And the interesting thing about that is, can you have an imperative? Can you have a commandment without a commander?
Mm.
Right? Because these are people who say, well, I'm Jewish, but I'm not a believer, or I'm spiritual, I'm not religious. And so I always like to dig into that with people and what they're really saying. Because usually, I would say without exception, when people say to me, you know, I'm not a believer, I don't believe in God, I just say, well, what do you believe in? And they always without exception, go on to articulate some very, you know, very deeply spiritual concept. They'll say something like, you know, nature or humanity or love or, you know, whatever, which is what I mean when I say God. So what their real objection is now this is just particularly for Jews, I think, but probably others. When American Jews or Western Jews say, I don't believe in God, I think what they have really is not a spiritual objection, but a psycholinguistic objection. Because when we talk about God in English in America, we feel like we sound like evangelical Christians with whom we do not agree.
Right.
And so if I say something to you like, you know, God is love, you would think, is the rabbi like, is he a pastor? Does he have a TV show? No, does he like take credit cards? Who is this guy? Because when we say the word God, they've monopolized God talk in English and shut out the rest of us. And so I just tell people, use whatever word you want. I don't care. Do you think you made the sun rise this morning? No, we all know there's something at work greater than us. And whatever you want to call it is fine with me. We're all describing the same mystery. And I'm okay with that, because the word has, in a way, been so monopolized that it's verboten for most of us.
That's a fascinating conversation that I would love to have with you. And even just this idea of sort of the way that all, I mean, you think about sort of Abraham, right? I feel like a lot of people don't understand that there was theoretically, historically, or psychographically one patriarch of all three main significant religions, and that essentially everyone's talking about the same ineffable quality, right?
And the fundamental idea of the oneness. Because, okay, so the two great ideas, really world-changing ideas that Jews brought to the world, to civilization, through Torah, through the characters of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses. The first is this idea, this anti-pagan idea. You know, it was all a reaction against paganism. And one of the ideas of paganism is that there are multi-deities who live in a meta-universe above that of humankind, and for whom humankind is of little to no concern. And it's kind of like a Downton Abbey or Below Deck kind of thing, where there's this upper life and the lower life, and they mirror each other. And these gods are constantly at war with each other, the peace god and the war god, the earth and the sun god, the sun and the moon god, the earth and the water god, right? I'm oversimplifying, but in other words, the energy that sustains life in reality is an energy born of conflict, of tension. And then Judaism comes along and says, no, 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 no. It's all one. There's a single unifying principle to all of existence. And that existence is sustained through oneness and wholeness, not this. I mean, that's why our creation myth posits a single creator, so that existence is not at war with itself constantly in order to create the energy to sustain itself. So that's the first big idea. I wrote my rabbinical thesis on Einstein, and part of it was how his unified field theory was the same as the Shema, that all is one. The second big idea, also in contradistinction to paganism, is the pagan point of view, is that life is eternally cyclical. That you and I are merely the newest cast of actors playing out the identical drama of the cast before us and before that and before that and before that. And that there was nothing any of us could do to change the drama and change the narrative. And then Judaism comes along and says, no, no, no. Life is linear. Reality is linear, and we are not trapped in yesterday's ways. We have agency. We can change ourselves. We can change others. We can change the course of history and life itself. That's why Judaism doesn't date itself to a prior event. Jews see themselves in relation to a future event, which mm-hmm. is this messianic era or age. So we're oriented to the future, not the past. And this idea that life can change, that we can change, that's a very powerful, radical Jewish idea that has permeated all of Western culture.
Totally.
Not Eastern culture, but Western culture.
Hosting this podcast is a great privilege. I'm so grateful to all of you for listening and to the amazing teachers and thinkers and experts who join me every week. There's nothing better than going deep with someone who has spent a good amount of their life thinking about the issue in question. It's like going back to school. So what's another place to learn from some of the most remarkable experts alive today? Masterclass. There are over 180 Masterclass instructors, including experts in leadership, negotiation, writing, and cooking. You can learn from former FBI agent Chris Voss, who teaches negotiation, Carla Welch, who teaches personal style, Bobby Brown, who teaches us how to put on makeup, which is a new fascination for me, or Esther Perel, who teaches relational intelligence. Don't miss Esther's recent episode on pulling the thread. These instructors become your own personal mentors, helping you gain real life skills. I use Masterclass, and you should too. There are more than 200 classes to pick from, with new ones added every month. For example, my good friend and former Pulling the Thread guest, Emily Morse, is on there teaching about sex and communication. And if there's anyone you want to invite into the bedroom with you and your partner, It should be her. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. And right now, our listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/thread. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/thread. masterclass.com/thread. It's interesting. I work with this woman. This might be too out there for you. We'll see. But her name's Krissa Schumacher, and she channels Yeshua. And these transmissions, I think, are stunning from Yeshua. And he talks about very much being a Jew. And he also talks about, too, this idea of why polytheism or that version of paganism had to go, also in the sense of this overly, you could find a god to justify any action, and that there were terrible things happening in the name of this polytheistic idea, right? Like kids being disemboweled through rape, etc.
Being fed to, being sacrificed to Molech. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
That story about Abraham and Isaac is really a story that says we do not slaughter our children for God, right?
Right.
So,
yes.
Yeah. And Jesus was a rabbi teaching Judaism. It was really Paul who kind of reinvented the whole thing. And I'll tell you that.
And Paul then was potentially misinterpreted.
Yes. And I'll tell you, if the rabbis of the day had agreed that you could become saved without circumcision, if they had been willing to give up on circumcision as a way to be saved, to be made a Jew, there would be a billion Jews in the world today, not a billion Christians.
Why was that chosen as the covenant?
The truth is, no one knows for sure, but we do know that was, I have a theory about it, which is that back then, Judaism was a patrilineal religion. It became matrilineal around during the Roman period when Jewish women were getting raped and they didn't know who the fathers were. So the rabbis literally changed Judaism from patrilineal to matrilineal, because you always know who the mother is, at least back then. So it was patrilineal. And we all know, you know, what men think about their penises, right? It's the center of the universe. And in a way it is, if perpetuating the tribe is your primary concern. And even like, you know, when you swore an oath in the Bible, it says, for example, like Joseph put his hand under Jacob's thigh. That's a euphemism. You would actually hold a man's testes. That's where the word
testifying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You made a promise and you kept it. So this was the epicenter of existence. And I think that has something to do with why you would mark someone as a Jew in that way. But beyond that, who the hell knows? But we do know it was also meant, if you were an adult and wanted to convert, it was meant to really keep people out who weren't absolutely committed. And Paul was willing to forego it and say you could be saved without it. And people didn't walk to Christianity, they ran.
Right.
And you can understand why. And so I asked the preeminent scholar on what's called the intertestamental period. I said, you know, if the rabbis had been more flexible, would there be a billion Jews or a billion Christians in the world today? And he said unequivocally, there'd be a billion Jews.
Yeah.
Crazy, huh?
No, so it's fascinating. And I don't know as much about Paul as I would like, but reading like Bert Ehrman and sort of the way that, I mean, these ideas are so obvious when you hear them, but then you're like, oh, right. Like, there are no original documents, and all of this is transcribed and transcribed and translated and transcribed, and
right.
And people edited it according to the preferences of the day. And so isn't there a lot to suggest that a lot of the anti-Semitism that people sometimes read into Paul, or blaming of Jews for the death of Jesus, was a fabrication or was a retranslation centuries later and an insertion?
And with its own cultural bias.
It's really interesting. But the idea of Tiamat and this destruction of the goddess, and then we think about this idea of Adam and Eve, or that being a Sumerian myth that was then retold, right? I feel as a woman, and then a woman whose dad is Jewish, and so I always felt rejected by the faith.
Although you now know that originally Judaism was patrilineal.
So I count?
You absolutely count. Okay. It was the father. You now know why the law was changed.
Yeah.
So what the Reform movement, you know, Judaism has denominations, just like Christianity. The Reform movement said 40 years ago, look, if it was patrilineal at one point and matrilineal at another, then either should be acceptable to us.
Yeah.
So for most of the Jews in America, you're in.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But what's your perception of sort of the missing feminine principle or the fact that covenants were made with men? Like, how do women like me reconcile myself? How am I to reconcile myself with any faith?
The same way, you know, my little brother Greg is gay and I'm still a lover of Judaism. I think we need to get to a place where we're willing to say, you know, the tradition at that point in its evolution may, for whatever reason, have been correct in its own day, but they were wrong. I mean, if you're not willing to do that, then slavery's okay, concubinage is okay, stoning rebellious children to death is okay, excluding women, treating women like, not treating them like property, women as property, okay, stoning homosexuals to death is okay, and none of it's okay. Now, and I can give you every sort of explanation in the book about, oh, well, the homosexuality thing, if you look at it, it's in a long list of sexual crimes, and what they were really legislating against was the Greco-Roman idea of sex between grown men and small boys, and that's what they were talking about. I can, like, you know, there's this old joke, you can scratch an itch like this or like this. I can do this all day long, but I'm also comfortable saying it's just wrong.
Right. And the whole point here, as you mentioned earlier too, and this is, you know, I thought for some reason when I heard this in a Yeshua transmission, it really hit something deeply resonant in my heart. He said effectively, like, as you evolve the divine. Like, we are codependent in evolution here.
Yes,
and
of course. And yeah. There, God has a personality in the Bible. There's a whole, like, something called personalist theology, which, you know, that's the best humans can do with our small puny minds is to anthropomorphize God. I mean, we can't help it. And I think it's okay. It's the best we can do in some ways. So, you know, we have amendments to the Constitution. How do you feel about being an American given that women couldn't vote until 100 years ago? Well, they were wrong and now we're right. And okay. I mean, are you not American? Of course you are. Do you not share American values? Of course you do. Should it say brotherhood and sisterhood from sea to shining sea? Yeah, it should. It doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I think some of it is you just got to realize that all faith traditions are a response to modernity. And back then it was modernity. Like, slavery is a good example. The slavery of the Bible was a tremendous step forward, even though from our perspective, it seems like nothing but good old-fashioned subjugation and slavery. But actually, the fact that you could only keep a slave for 7 years and then the slave had to be allowed to go free unless the slave wanted to, the fact that the slave celebrated the Sabbath along with everyone else, there are all kinds of things that in and of its time were revolutionary and positive. But by today's standards, look, the way we're treating breast cancer today is going to look like leeching and bleeding in 50 years.
I know.
But
no, it's true.
What are you going to do? You know?
Yeah. No, exactly. And as you mentioned, you know, slavery, what the foundations of slavery are tied to the beginning of patriarchy when all women were enslaved effectively.
They were property.
Property, yeah.
But in the Torah, the daughters of Zelophehad, you know, the inheritance was always the eldest son and there was no son. And they go to Moses and say, you know, this isn't fair. And guess what? Moses says, you're right. And you have the right to inherit property. So we do We do make progress. We're evolving. And, you know, I think that's just the nature of civilization. So I think as a woman, I can't speak for you, obviously, or feel for you, obviously, but I would say that it's perfectly fine to say they were just, they may have been right in their own day, but they're certainly wrong by today's standards. I actually think 1,000 years from now, when historians write about this period we're living in right now, Jewish historians or historians of Judaism, they will conclude that the full and complete inclusion of women as equals in Jewish life by the Reform movement is the single most important development of our era. And by era, I'm talking about 2 or 3 centuries of Jewish life.
Yeah,
I think it's going to be looked back on as the great decision.
Going back to this idea of death, because I think about this in my own life and becoming a more spiritual, far more spiritual person this Saturday. So in 3 days, it's the 5-year anniversary of my brother-in-law dying suddenly in his sleep when he was 39. My brother's husband, he was my best friend. And that really, as I'm sure you've seen in your tending to thousands of people who are dying or are in mourning, for me was the door. Like that was a moment in my life of transcendent. I don't even know how to describe it. I'm sure this is something you've observed over and over and over again, but it was a door that I walked through that completely changed my life.
Yes. You know, Kafka said the meaning of life is that it ends. And it really is that simple.
It really is.
Yes, it is. But until you experience that reality, there is this almost necessary denial that is required. I mean, we know theoretically people die who, and people we love could die. But until it actually happens, you cannot grasp the profundity of it. You know, I've always wanted to write this book called How to Have Your Second Child First. It's a right? It's a great title, okay? But you can't write that book. You have to live the first in order to raise the second the way you raise the second. I can give you books about swimming and show you Netflix specials on swimming, and I could bring Lenny Crazelton in or whoever to talk to you about swimming. I could do that for 20 years and put you in the pool and you're going to drown because I've only taught you about swimming. I haven't gotten in the water with you. You haven't gotten in the water. And so what happened to your brother-in-law moved you from a theoretical understanding of death and therefore life. Mm-hmm. And a theoretical understanding of grief and loss to the real thing. And that's what changed you, was the reality of it. And you know, I wish what I'm about to say wasn't true. I have come to the conclusion that death is not only the great teacher, it is the only teacher. Imagine if we lived deathless lives. We'd be something other than human for sure.
Yeah.
No one would have ambition. No one would change anything. No one would probably have a partner. No one would have children. There would literally be no purpose to existence. It would be like that paganism, but not generationally. It would just be individuals living in the same bloody circle all the time. So it is actually death that gives life its meaning.
No, I profoundly agree. It gives it, obviously, the measure. There's also the promise in some ways of, which I know seems so counter. It's such a, as I'm sure you've found writing about this, this is the one thing that people don't want to talk about or contemplate or think about. It's too scary. And yet it's the only doorway that actually gives you any freedom from that fear. So it offers tremendous liberation. But getting there, getting to the point where you have to tussle with it is something that most of us, I mean, even reading the opening quote, I was in tears. It's so hard to think about. Our attachments are so deep. And the idea isn't to detach, right? That's the point.
Well, I once, in my very first book, which was like 30 years ago, I wrote an essay called All Life is Separation. And I think that was, you know, that was early Steve Leader, was the embryonic phase of what, of the book in front of you now, really, all these years later. And it helps people to know, and I've had this conversation with literally more than 1,000 people, when people are actually actively dying, I'm talking about a day or two, and I visit with them, I always ask, you know, are you afraid? Elise, are you afraid? And the answer 100% of the time has been no. Because when you are really dying, it is the most natural thing in the world. And the closest example I can give you that we, the living, can appreciate is, think of the time you were suffering the worst jet lag in your life. I mean, you were just leaden. All you wanted to do was get into that hotel room bed and pull the covers up and go to sleep. You didn't care it was noon. You weren't afraid to go to sleep. You weren't anxious about going to sleep. You weren't sorry about or remorseful. All you want to do is rest. And that's what it is to be dying for most people. To some people get hit by buses, sure, but they're not afraid of dying either because they didn't see it coming.
Right.
So the counterintuitive good news here for people who don't want to think about death or dying and or are afraid of death is, if you are afraid of dying, it's not your day. Anxiety is for the living. Okay, so when you're really, I know it's funny, but you know, it's helpful. When you're really dying, you'll be fine. Better than fine.
Yeah.
If you're worried about it, take a breath, because it's not your day. And I find that that also helps us approach the dying differently. You know, there's just so much to talk about here, but that basic fundamental fear is generally not evidenced in death.
When I was in my early 20s, and let's just say not living my best life, my late brother-in-law and best friend, Peter, took me to France. Ostensibly, we were going to see and stay with his aunt, but really, I think he wanted to cheer me up. We went to the flea markets in the countryside on the weekends, where I found a set of very old religious medals. I decided to invest these medals with the belief that everything in my life could shift, and it did. I figured out how to frame them myself very badly, and they've stayed with me ever since. When Peter passed away in 2017, these medals became even more important to me, earning pride of place next to my desk. I look at them every day. But my poor framing job from 2002 started to fail recently, and so I decided to entrust them to Framebridge. I've been having Framebridge frame all of my family photos for years. You can upload digital prints, and they do a beautiful and speedy job, making them the perfect place for holiday gifts, as my mother-in-law and parents treasure photos of my kids. But Framebridge also takes on objects that are typically expensive and difficult to frame, whether it's menus, tickets, original artwork, personal milestones, license plates, hotel keys, keys to your first home, or in my case, medals. You can easily order online at framebridge.com or visit one of their 20-plus Framebridge retail stores. They provide free, secure, prepaid packaging for physical items, and you can ship them on over. They will then frame your piece and ship it to you in days. It's easy. It's affordable. You know exactly what it will cost up front, and they offer every conceivable framing option. Everything I've ever sent Framebridge has always looked even better than I expected. Plus, if you're not 100% happy with your piece, they'll make it right. See why Framebridge has been trusted to frame over 2 million pieces. Visit framebridge.com or a local Framebridge store to get started and custom frame just about anything. That's framebridge.com. Do you find, you know, so Peter, who was 39, died in his sleep of an undiagnosed heart condition. And it's funny because he was, in some ways, the most complete person that I know. at 39. And he obviously didn't want to die and had no idea that he was going to die. But yet it was at his older brother's wedding, and there were like hundreds of photos taken of him the day before he died. There was like something incredible, like his whole family was there. But I think of him and the way that my brother eulogized him as like the most complete person I know. And in some ways, you know, not that he was prepared, and that's a whole nother thing. And we need to talk about ethical wills and also just like the practicalities of preparing for your death, because it is a loving thing to do, the most loving thing you can do. So he was not practically prepared, but there was something about his life as it was, and there were 1,500, I mean, this is what happens at young people's funerals, right?
Yes,
probably indeed. 1,800 yes. people there.
Yes.
And it's not a rose-colored experience of him, if that makes sense. So is that your experience when people who are young pass, that there is this, of course they needed more time, and yet, I mean, I don't want to make it trite, but that there's a completeness?
Well, it depends on the person.
Yeah.
Peter sounds to me like he was the kind of person who really chose to live until he would die, whenever that would be. He didn't live his life waiting. You know, there was many years ago, a psychologist named William Marston who did a study, and he asked, I think it was 3,000 people, what they were waiting for.
What do you have to live for? That was the question.
Well, yeah, what do you have to live for? And they were, that's right. And they were all waiting for something.
Yeah.
I'm waiting to pay off the mortgage. I'm waiting till the kids go to college. I'm waiting to lose weight. I'm waiting to, you know, retire. And it was like 90% of people waiting instead of living. Peter sounds to me like he was living.
Yeah.
Not that we don't have some sense of delayed gratification, etc., but he lived until he died. And that is one of the ways in which death can be a great teacher. When my father died, and you know, the beauty of What Remains is sort of this journey from Steve the rabbi to Steve the son, and how much the rabbi got wrong when he was the son. But my relationship to money, for example, has changed significantly since my father died. Like, we're building that little house in Joshua Tree in the desert. I'm not waiting. I am not waiting. If my father knew what we were spending on the hardware alone, he'd like come back to haunt me, you know? But I think that death is a completeness, and it's robbery, but only for the living. You know, I often say, I'll let you in on a little rabbi trade secret of mine. When you're constructing a eulogy, and when I teach this to rabbinical students, I tell them the very first thing you have to do is you have to address the feeling in the room. You have to dial into the frequency of the people in that room, of the living. And so in the case of Peter's death, the frequency was, this is so awful for him. This is so awful for him. And this is also true, you know, when sometimes it's cancer or Alzheimer's, whatever. This is so terrible. And my first job is to say, this is our pain. This is our loss, not his. He's beyond pain and loss, wherever he is, wherever his soul is. It's beyond pain and loss and doctors and needles and tubes or the nursing home or the wheelchair or the war. This is our sorrow. The rabbis called death menucha nechona, perfect sleep. Mm. Obviously, it's a metaphor, but it's the perfect part that's important. It's a part of the wholeness of life. And I would say, when people ask me, you know, what do you think about the afterlife? I say, well, I do believe, because I've seen so many dead bodies, that there's so much more to us than our bodies, so much more to us than our corporeal beings. You know, when I looked at my dad's body, that wasn't my dad.
Right.
So there's more to us than the physical. But when people ask me, you know, what do you think about it? I say, I think about it as much as I think about what life was like before I was born. What was my life before I was born? I don't know. And I don't think about it. Do you ever think about where you were before you were born? If anywhere?
Well, who knows? I kind of believe we've been here many times, but I don't know.
Who knows? Do you lose any sleep over it?
No.
No. And so I kind of look at it like that. Like, it's the great mystery. And
yeah,
we'll know when we know.
But it's interesting, and you get at this sort of practically and spiritually in this new book, but this idea of the word, I loved that sort of etymology lesson in Hebrew, and this idea that word and thing are the same, and the ephemeral nature, like the impact of us as we live on in our ancestors' bodies. And I think about the way that you talked about sort of the corporal nature of someone's presence. And with Peter, it's like, well, how can he be dead? Because I think about him all the time. I channel what he would do all the time. I talk to him in his mind. I have the sensation of him around me all the time.
He's not dead. His body died.
Yes. Yes.
Body died. That's it.
Yeah.
That is a real death, you know? But I'll give you, there are many types of deaths. My father died twice because he had Alzheimer's for 10 years. So he died when his brain was no longer the brain of the person who was my father. And then his body died 5 years after that. And both deaths were really painful. But there's a third existence that he has within me. And, you know, we don't tend to think about this biologically, but also in my DNA, and therefore the DNA of my children and theirs and theirs and theirs. And I think it's all beautiful. That's why I called that book The Beauty of What Remains. And this new book called For You When I Am Gone is really an opportunity I'm presenting people. You know, people think it's, oh, Leader wrote another book about death. No, 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 no. This is really a book about your life. And, you know, we're going through this great reevaluation right now. I know you're living it with your kind of new life and this novel you're writing. And I'm living it. And we're all reevaluating. And this book is a series of questions. There are 12 questions that enable every person who's willing to answer them to reevaluate their life and their legacy. Because what I have found with my father's death is I miss not a single material thing about my father. I mean, I have his hat on the shelf behind me and I have a couple of his old tools. But that's it. What I really cherish, the inheritance I really cherish, are the values, the laughter, the music, the food, my love of nature. That's his legacy. His powerful bullshit meter, his powerful moral compass, his love of peoplehood. That's what we want to be sure we bequeath to our loved ones when we're gone. But it's more than just a bequest, because when you ask yourself questions like, what is love? What makes me happy? What has been my greatest failure? What do I regret? What do I want my epitaph to be? What would I say at my own funeral as a final blessing to my loved ones? These are the kinds of questions that enable us to ask whether or not we are living the life we say we believe in and the life we say matters. It's what I call alignment. You know, we're all a little out of alignment. Every human being, you know, we all have a set of professed and believed values, and then there are lived values, and they're never completely aligned. You know, I tell my kids, I hope you're close, but I haven't called one of my sisters in 3 months. So, you know, I mean, we all have a little of that, okay? But I think the pandemic and this book are an opportunity to really ask ourselves, am I living my truth? Or is my life some kind of kabuki? And if I'm not living my truth, what am I going to do about it? So that I can speak and live with integrity as I age. And maybe this is what happened when Peter died for you to some degree. Like, what am I doing with my inner and outer life? And am I living in a truthful way? Mm-hmm. Or is it kabuki? That's just so important for us and for the legacy we leave. My editor asked me, well, how long did it take you to come up with these questions and put them in this order? And I said, it took me 35 years and 15 minutes. Because these questions are the questions I ask families when I do what's called an intake meeting, which is when I sit with families to try to understand the truth of their loved one's life so that I can write a eulogy about this person. And, you know, when I teach rabbinical students, again, I always talk to them about the difference between an obituary and a eulogy. An obituary gives you the facts of a person's life. A eulogy should give you the truths of a person's life. You know, the fact that I was born on June 3rd in 1960 in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, doesn't tell you very much. It's a set of facts. What I'm trying to get to when I need to tell a person's story is the truth of their life. And these questions are the questions I've been asking families for 35 years to get to the truth of a person's life. And that is a beautiful journey. You know, like Marshall McLuhan said, I don't know who discovered water, but it wasn't the fish. Isn't that great? What does a fish know? It's born in water, lives in water, dies in water, doesn't know it's in water, has no perspective on its own life.
Yeah.
When does a fish discover water? Yeah. When it's jerked out of the water and it's wriggling and flailing at the end of a hook. That's when a fish discovers water. When something disruptive happens. And that's what happened when Peter died, peacefully as it was for him. It was disruptive for you. It jerked you out of the water.
Yeah, broke me open.
Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country. The kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
So interesting, too, you know, going back to this idea of davar, the word for thing or word, because we, you know, culturally, as if we're responsible adults, right, we make a will and we determine where all of our physical things will go.
Right.
And then this is a call actually for, you know, what you describe as an ethical will, which is part of the Jewish tradition for millennia. Mm-hmm. But it is the word, right? It is like, what are the sentiments? What are the values? Which, having been through this experience, is ultimately infinitely the thing that you want. Because we always think we're waiting, right? Also to be like, we'll have time to tell everyone who
yes.
we care about how we feel.
Another COVID lesson, which, right? I think we all had our sense of invulnerability pierced. We're all vulnerable. And you really never know. You really never know. I don't know about you, Elise, but I have found myself in the midst of and post-pandemic expressing love so much more frequently and effusively than before. And I don't think I was a, you know, withholding person before. But when I meet a friend now for a drink, or I talk to one of my kids, or I finish a Zoom with colleagues at work, I literally say, I love you. I love you. I love you too. And I'm ending texts with, you know, love you. I love you. And a heart. I didn't used to do that. And I think it is because of this omnipresence of impending doom, or at least vulnerability. And And I think that's a positive force if we don't allow it to consume us, but if we allow it to ennoble us.
Yeah.
Right? Dostoevsky said his greatest fear was that his life would not be worthy of his suffering. Wow.
Wow.
Can your life be worthy of Peter's death?
Yes.
That's ennobling. That's powerful. So this idea of an ethical will pushes us beyond the idea that the material will somehow express something important to our loved ones, because it doesn't. You know what? One of the saddest moments of my life, it's still really hard to talk about. Almost everything that was my father's ended up in a heap on the basement floor. Mm-hmm. The goodwill didn't even want it. Mm-hmm. That's not his legacy. You know, believing that our estate plan is going to nourish our loved ones is like trying to feed them a picture of food. It's not nourishing the paperweight collection or the fountain pens or the what. Nobody cares. So let's leave our loved ones words, because that is real in a way things never could be or will be. And let's not wait. You know, someone asked me the other day if I had to kind of give the book, you know, in two words, what is the real message of this book? And it just flew out of me. I didn't know the question in advance, and it took me no time to respond. I said, don't wait. Mm-hmm. Don't wait to tell the people you care about of your love, of your life lessons, of your hopes and dreams and blessings for them. Don't wait. I didn't know my last conversation with my father was my last conversation with my father, because one day, one visit, he could talk, and the next, he never really spoke again. So, and I don't think this is a dark reason. I think it's a powerful and beautiful reason to create an ethical will. You know, you're a writer, so you know, you never out earn the advance. So what I'm about to say has nothing to do with money, okay? Right? You never get more. You never out earn the advance, because the accounting is just so bogus when it comes to books, right? So I really hope that this book inspires hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, to take the time to ask themselves these questions and answer them for themselves and for their loved ones when they're gone. It is the only gift that will matter. It is the only bequest. It is the only inheritance that will really matter.
I know. I am inspired. Well, you've inspired me to do it. I've been thinking about it. I'm going to do it this weekend to my kids and my husband.
That's so great. Wow.
Yeah, see, no, I really.
To me, and I'm not, we barely know each other, but I'm quite sincere in saying this to you. To me, knowing that makes writing the book worthwhile. It's enough for me. It's more than enough that one person is going to go through this process and leave something of real value.
Yeah. And then the one practical thing that I did do, which I would append to this, which is make a Google Doc with your passwords, your wishes, your information. Like, don't send your loved ones on a scavenger hunt,
right,
for the parts of your life. Like, we also, because people are so scared of this or unprepared for this, there are ways, because as you mentioned, like, you're eulogizing someone. All you want in that moment, even though they're gone, is to honor their wishes. But if you don't know what they are, you can't do it. So
that's right.
Yeah. There's that, and as well.
Yeah. And I see the difference when I'm dealing with a family where, after a death, the anxiety level, the chaos that exists when the person who died did not plan is extreme. It's enormous. And often we're dealing with an elderly surviving spouse for whom it is just too damn much.
Yeah.
You want to do that to someone you say you love?
Yeah.
And you know, there are other parts of this too. At least like my wife says this to me all the time when we're watching some horrific story on TV or something. She'll say, if that ever happens to me, just shoot me. Well, if that ever happens, just shoot me is not a plan. You know, you can't do that. So
doesn't work.
No, you really need to lay it out very specifically. Yeah. There are forms that will help guide you to do it. And it's actually a very powerful life-affirming experience. It helps clarify what you believe is valuable about life. That's the power of death. And so, you know, and I have to circle back to this idea, which you articulated, you know, that I talk about in the book, that in Hebrew, you cannot differentiate between words and things. They're the same. You know, I'll tell you something interesting. You know, abracadabra that magicians say? That's an Aramaic phrase from the Talmud. Abara kedibara. As I speak, I create.
Mm.
Words create. Look at the Bible. And God said,
yeah,
let there be light. And there was light.
Yeah.
Words. We create worlds of meaning with our words. You know, whoever said sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me was completely wrong. I don't remember my many skin knees from childhood, but boy, I remember when I got up to bat for Little League every time and all the kids yelling, little leader, little leader, because I was the shortest kid on the team. Or, hey, get off your knees, stand up.
Mm.
I remember that, right? So words are
very
real. They really matter. They're very real, and they can hurt and they can heal. And they can bestow a legacy upon your loved ones, and they can help you live your truth. That's really what the book is about.
And just to tie our whole wide-ranging conversation, the stories that we tell about ourselves matter, and they can also evolve and change. And
yeah. Muriel Rukeyser wrote this poem in which she said, the world is not made up of atoms. The world is made up of stories. And it's true. Our bodies disintegrate. Our life is really defined by our story.
And whose stories have historically mattered, but as we are also recognizing, like, that's not the whole story. So as we move forward, how do we put together a tapestry that's actually increasingly accurate?
That's why the book asks questions that are indelicate. Have you ever had to cut someone toxic out of your life? Why? What is your biggest failure? What is your biggest regret? Right? Mm-hmm. Because if you're not willing to be vulnerable in that way, you will never really share your truth. You will never live your truth. And so, yes, it is the imperfection. I'll put it this way, be a little religious again, if you'll forgive me. So there's a phrase in the Bible that says, God puts God's words upon our hearts. And the rabbis of the Talmud, the sages, ask this question, why upon our hearts and not in our hearts? I mean, surely if God has the power to put words upon our hearts, God could put words in our hearts. And here's the answer they give. They say God puts words upon our hearts, and it isn't until our hearts are broken that the words can enter. So in other words, in certain ways, and this goes back to your feelings after Peter died, in certain ways we are actually more whole when broken. And therefore, when we're telling our story and articulating our story and living our story, the brokenness of it is also part of its beauty and power. And I wish there was another way. Believe me, it's not worth the tuition. to learn these lessons, okay? But we don't have a choice. We just don't have a choice about that. And what we do have a choice about is whether or not we're worthy of that suffering. You know, are we going to come out of hell empty-handed or not? Most of us come out ennobled, broken and whole, yeah. Because it's only that level of vulnerability and authenticity and truth that will enable them to embrace our story and live and grow from it.
I hope you all are inspired as well to think about the words that you would leave with the people that you love. I can't, having gone through this experience, what I wouldn't give for a last letter from Peter. And I know we think that we say these things all the time and we express them all over the place and we're all making so much content, right? And tracking our lives and commemorating our lives with photographs. But that in of itself can be an overwhelming project to go back into and a painful project. And so there's something about the simplicity of last words that not only feels like such a gift, but it also, I think, as Rabbi Steve was saying, is an opportunity to lean into our own lives and ensure that that alignment that he's spoken of, that is so essential to all of us, is present in how we're passing our time. And I wanted to leave you with this quote from his book, which I thought was really beautiful. Steve writes, "The Nobel Prize-winning author Isaac Bashevis Singer said, 'The dead don't go anywhere. They're all here. Each man is a cemetery, an actual cemetery in which lie all our grandmothers and grandfathers, the father and mother, the wife, the child. Everyone is here all the time.'" Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to this week's episode. You can find show notes and full transcripts of the episodes at theelisepodcast.com. Please sign up for my newsletter. I promise I won't spam you. Or follow me on Instagram at Elise Lunan to get updates on new episodes. I'd also like to give a huge thank you to my sponsors who make this show possible. Please support them the way they support this podcast. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studio. If you enjoyed this episode, please listen, rate, review, and follow Pulling the Thread, available now for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts, i.e. wherever you're listening right now. I also want to thank you in advance for sharing any episodes with friends who you think might like the show, because that is how podcasts grow. I want to give a shout out to Phil Svitek, Lauren LaGrasso, Serena Reagan, Mary-Kate McDonough, and the entire Cadence 13 team for producing these episodes, and to Valero Duval for my key art. Take care of yourselves. I'll see you next week.